Welcome back. 447, 730 AM, 102.9 FM, WTNT. Andy Parks live from the Washington Times on this Wednesday afternoon. I'm joined now by Stephen Dinan, Washington Times political editor. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Andy.
Slow path to progress for U.S. immigrants. We get this report from the Center for Immigration Studies, and it tells us what? We have a whole bunch of immigrants?
It tells us we have a whole bunch. We have more than ever, and that's, of course, legal and illegal. So this is the broad population. We have more than ever. As a percentage of the population, they are a higher percentage than they have been since basically the last giant wave at the turn of the last century, so up until 1910 or so. So we have the most, the highest percentage of immigrants in our population that we've had in a century. And in particular, it tells us that assimilation is more than just are they learning to speak English, are they getting jobs. It is, especially with the modern welfare state and the supports that the federal government and state and local governments provide, it goes on and looks at a bunch of measures of economic well-being for immigrants, especially long-time immigrants who have been in the country 20 years, and finds that even after that long time, they still lag well behind native-born Americans on a number of those economic measures. And, you know, the implication there is that immigration is a lot more than just, hey, how many people are we letting in and what countries are we letting them in from? It's once you decide you're going to let them in, the country has to be aware of the costs that go along with that, the social cost, the actual financial cost to the government, and essentially you have a population that is likely to be lower income overall, likely to have lower English skills overall, likely to make a greater use of welfare overall, and just so all those economic measures of well-being.
Hmm. They don't do as well as citizens, as natural-born citizens. That shouldn't be a shocker, is it?
No, but the not shocker, but I guess the interesting part is even after 20 years of being here, you know, assimilation means a lot of different things.
Yeah.
But you'd think that with 20 years here, there wouldn't be as big a gap as there is. One very interesting finding is that the immigrants who have been here 20 years have a 43% use rate for at least one welfare benefit,
wow,
which is much higher than immigrants who've been here less than 20 years. You know, so it seems like, and that is that rate, 43%, is nearly double the rate for native-born Americans. And so that in and of itself, that, you know, 20 years, you'd think at that point, if they generally tracked with the native-born or were getting close to the levels of native-born in terms of economic proficiency and whatnot, that number should probably be a lot lower than twice as much as native-born.
Hmm. All right. On to the part about denying visas to illegals who appear to have no means of supporting themselves. I thought that was a prerequisite, that you had to come into the country and you had to show that you were able to have work, or you already had it lined up, and now Republicans are questioning that, or what?
Sure. So, as you said, it is part of federal law that to be granted a visa, you have to show that you have means of support. In fact, in a lot of cases, of course, you're sponsored, and your sponsor has to say, this person won't become a public charge. It's unclear how much the federal government actually pays attention to that requirement. And a couple of senators, actually a group of four senators, Republican senators, yesterday wrote a letter to the Homeland Security Department and the State Department, who basically decide they're the ones who issue visas. This actually stems from the last month. There's been this discussion of the federal government and food stamp benefits, and the Agriculture Department working in conjunction with Mexican authorities to try and help Mexicans in the U.S. who would be eligible for food stamps, using like Spanish language radio telenovelas to encourage those people to sign up for food stamp benefits. And stemming from that, it turns out that the senators became aware that the federal government only checks two different welfare programs to see if people are on those welfare programs when they go back and decide when they decide whether somebody is likely to become a public charge or not. And so that's a very long way of saying the senators basically sent a letter to Secretary Napolitano and Secretary Clinton saying, hey, the law says these people are not supposed to become public charges. First of all, are you guys actually enforcing that? And second of all, if you are taking a look at that, it looks like you're only looking at two different measures of welfare programs that they may or may not be using right now. Why don't you take a look at all of the different welfare programs that are out there and make a proper judgment on whether they're likely to be public charges based on their use of all of the welfare programs? Don't just limit it to two programs.
Huh. All right. I want to move on to another story that caught my eye, and I laughed out loud because the headline is "Work Getting Done on Senate Floor," literally. What is this all about? There's a revamping going on?
There is. This is one of those crazy things where the Senate was so sure it didn't want to be in working this August that it actually scheduled a full 5-week restoration of the Senate floor and carpet. And so the floor is entirely torn up. When I walked in this morning, there were sanding sounds and refinishing sounds coming from the chamber down below the press gallery where I work. And the carpet has been torn up. The whole thing is just, you know, it's completely empty. All the 100 historic desks of, you know, the likes of everyone from, you know, just the great senators and orators of old have sat in. All of those have been taken out of there. The chamber's empty. Now, this matters because last week the House refused to adjourn, and we talked about this before. When one chamber refuses to adjourn under the Constitution, the other has to stay in session as well. That was the way that the House had tried to deny Obama his recess appointments earlier in the year. But so the House had refused to adjourn. Actually, it was Democrats who refused to allow them to adjourn. And so because the House refused to adjourn, the Senate was going to have to come into session, these pro forma sessions throughout the summer as well. And that was a real problem because there's no Senate chamber for them to actually use. And so they were poised for the second time, only the second time since the Capitol was reconstructed after the British burned it in the War of 1812, they were poised to hold a meeting in a chamber outside of their, or in a place outside of their official chamber for only the second time, the first time being last year's earthquake.
Yeah.
It turns out that all got averted because at the last moment early yesterday morning, the Democrats relented and let the House go out for vacation. So obviously, I don't know if Harry Reid got on the phone to Nancy Pelosi and said, hey, you're going to cause us all sorts of problems or what, but the Democrats relented and the House officially adjourned, which meant that the Senate could officially adjourn, so they did not have to have the special sessions over in a different building.
So when it's done, what is it we will have purchased besides a new floor? Anything else?
A new floor, a new carpet that will look exactly like the old carpet, and probably some... they said there will be some electronic telecommunications upgrades, and I'm not exactly sure what that constitutes. When people say that, you never know whether that's just updating the internet lines or whether there's something more high-tech going on. The other thing I should mention is that a cost figure is unavailable. The Senate says that all of this work is being done by their in-house staff, and so there's no way to break out a cost for what they're doing.
Yeah, shocker, shocker.
Yeah.
Speaking about paying out lots of money, I see you've just posted a story on the IRS paying out billions in bogus refunds.
Yeah, so this is an audit by the Inspector General from that oversees the IRS, and it's actually, you know, a lot of times when you read these audits, they're couched in very diplomatic language and whatnot. Not so much in this case. The press release that the auditor issued actually is pretty blunt, and it says not only is the IRS paying out more than five, or in 2010 paid out more than $5 billion in potentially fraudulent refunds, essentially refunds to people who were probably using identity theft, but IRS supervisors actively told their employees tried to warn the IRS about some of these different schemes and different ways they could go after this fraud, and the supervisors actively urged the employees to disregard those warnings.
Really?
So, yeah, and that's the really shocking part of this, is that the IRS, you know, some of those employees had complained to Congress, and Congress asked the Inspector General to go investigate it, and the Inspector General substantiated those complaints, and that's really, really brutal.
Oh, man. All right. Well, I look forward to hearing more on this story as we go forward. And as always, I thank you for your help this afternoon. We'll talk again. Thanks, Stephen.
My pleasure.
Stephen Dinan, Washington Times political editor. That is quite a story. The IRS paid out billions, with a B, in bogus refunds under Program for Immigrants. Wow. More on that coming up, I'm sure. 4:57, 7:30 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT. It's Andy Parks live from the Washington Times.